is available at thecedar.org.
You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and around the world at kfai.org. The community's true voice. During the height of the civil rights movement, Dave and Iola Brubeck wrote a jazz musical for Louis Armstrong.
Remember who you are and what you represent.
Always we started writing a show based on a jazz band headed by Louis Armstrong on a State Department tour of the world.
The eyes of the world are watching you. Remember who you are and what you represent.
The real ambassadors was the music of this country. Music is what overcomes everything.
The Real Ambassadors, a story about integration, cultural exchange, social justice, and it's a love story. Produced by the Kitchen Sisters and Brandy Howell. Coming up.
Good afternoon and welcome to Mini Culture Presents, KFAI's audio and documentary showcase. I'm your host, Mike Whetstone. Today on Mini Culture Presents, you heard it there at the top, we are going to hear a program called The Real Ambassadors, an hour-long, sound-rich music history documentary program. The Jazz Ambassadors program was established by President Eisenhower and the U.S. State Department during the mid-1950s. And during the Cold War, in an effort to win the hearts and minds of folks around the world. It is exactly the soft power which America is now starting to squander, taking for granted and losing that power right now. Look no further than the Voice of America radio network that is in peril. Anyway, jazz musicians were sent out into the world to represent the freedom and creativity of America. They were treated like royalty around the globe, but often could not stay in hotels or play in integrated bands in their own country. This documentary was produced by the Kitchen Sisters, Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson. We've played a couple of their documentaries over the years, including ones about the singer Edith Piaf, sound archivist Tony Swartz, and the WHER, all-female radio station. Everything that the Kitchen Sisters do is quite wonderful and worthy, and I think you're going to find this documentary to be nothing different, nothing less. Here is the Kitchen Sisters, The Real Ambassadors, a rallying cry for integration, cultural exchange, and social justice.
On a chilly evening in September 1962, The Real Ambassadors, a musical written by Dave and Iola Brubeck, was performed at the Monterey Jazz Festival. It was unusual, unprecedented. A mixed cast of well-known artists in the heat of the civil rights movement, challenging racial prejudice and social injustice through jazz. The Kitchen Sisters and Brandy Howell present The Real Ambassadors.
Once again, it's time for the Dave Brubeck Show.
Mike Lawless here, and sitting across from me is a friend of Dave Brubeck's, a pretty good friend too, Iola Brubeck. First, Ollie, when did the original idea for a Broadway show come about?
About 5 years ago, when we were still living in California, Dave was playing in the East. I came out one summer, and I went to, I guess, every musical that was running at that time. I went over to Central Park one night to a jazz concert. I listened to Joe Williams. Joe Williams was the guy who, you know, the goose pimple test, was the one who really reached emotionally.
every day. Every day I have blues.
He reached me much greater than any of the Broadway shows, with all the great lavish sets, storylines, and I thought to myself, well, the time has come to do a real jazz musical.
Nobody loves me. Nobody seems to get it.
We started writing a show based on a jazz band headed by Louis Armstrong on a State Department tour of the world. In 1958, Dave himself actually went on a State Department tour.
President Eisenhower sent us on a tour at a time when there was a great conflict between the United States and Russia to help bring our cultures together. This was such a wonderful move to make, to show the great discipline of jazz and the great freedom.
The jazz ambassadors, Duke Ellington, Dave Brubeck, Dizzy Gillespie, were chosen to go overseas on behalf of Uncle Sam. My name is Keith Hatchek, author of The Real Ambassadors, Dave and Iola Brubeck, and Louis Armstrong Challenge Segregation. These jazz ambassadors, who were largely African-American, were really treated like royalty overseas. But when they got home, they were immediately subjected to the same kind of Jim Crow, oh, Mr. Armstrong, you'll have to come in through the loading dock at the Waldorf Astoria. You can't actually come in through the front door, even though you're playing here.
That was an injustice that really started gnawing at my dad. I'm Chris Brubeck, the third child of Dave and Iola Brubeck. My mom's reaction was to write The Real Ambassadors.
Before they left in 1958 on the tour, they had to go to a briefing. A very sort of officious man says, when controversy comes up, you head in the opposite direction. You should just be smiling and playing your music. Remember who you are.
Remember who you are and what you represent. Never face a problem. Always circumvent. Stay away from issues. Be discreet. When controversy enters, you retreat.
Remember who you are and what you represent. Always be a credit to your government. No matter what you say or what you do, the eyes of the world are watching you. Remember.
It begins by talking about Thomas Jefferson and Lincoln and the founding principles, but by the end, they're swinging and singing about Count Basie and Jelly Roll, what it means to live a full and good life.
Jelly Roll and Basie helped us to invent a weapon that no other nation has, especially the Russians can't claim jazz. Remember who you are.
The truth is, Louis Armstrong was the one who influenced the State Department Jazz Ambassador Tours. My name's Ricky Riccardi, Director of Research Collections for the Louis Armstrong House Museum. In 1955, Louis embarked on a three-month tour of Europe. There was literally riots in Germany, crowds screaming for him in Paris, and there was such a buzz that Columbia Records records this album called Ambassador Satch. The New York Times, at the end of 1955, wrote, America's greatest weapon is a blue note in a minor key, and right now its most effective ambassador is Louis Armstrong. That really got the State Department involved. Adam Clayton Powell really drove the show to make it happen.
We're going to shift the emphasis to jazz, then send these artists over where they can reach the masses of the people of Asian Africa.
Passports.
Shots.
Identification.
Visas.
In 1957, the State Department was getting ready to send him to Russia, but that's when Armstrong put his career on the line to speak out against racial injustice in Little Rock, Arkansas.
Little Rock, Arkansas, and the first phase of the trouble. The white population are determined to prevent colored students from going to the school their own children attend.
Armstrong had not spoken out before, and he had been getting some criticism from younger African-American commentators throughout the 1950s.
When he turned on the TV in his hotel room and he saw the tragedy that was unfolding in Little Rock with the effort to integrate Central High School, he immediately called the hotel front desk and said, I need to dictate a telegram to the White House.
National newspapers published the story. Satchmo calls Ike a coward, and he belittled the governor of Arkansas, Orville Faubus. If these people are allowed to spit on a little black girl who can't even go to school, a person like me doesn't even have a country.
What are you going to tell the Russians when they ask you about the Little Rock incident?
It all depends what time they send me over there. I don't think they should send me now unless they straighten that mess down south.
The Brubecks had a news clipping of that in their little paper file, and that was one more piece of inspiration that they used in creating the character of Pops for the real ambassadors.
One, two, three.
I'm the real ambassador. It is evident I wasn't sent by government to take your place.
The Armstrong's band, the All-Stars, it was an integrated band. He often had white musicians. When they would tour the South, he could not play with that band in New Orleans, his home state of Louisiana.
So I represent the government. The government don't represent some policies I'm...
In 1949, being crowned the king of the Mardi Gras, to not be able to give a free concert, this was tearing him up.
Segregation is a legality, isn't it? Thank you very much, folks. Here's one of our recordings. Beautiful number called Black and Blue.
After Armstrong spoke out against Little Rock, he kind of made it his policy to stop speaking out until March of 1965. During the march on Selma, Alabama, Bloody Sunday, Armstrong was on his way to go behind the Iron Curtain for the very first time. Reporters in Denmark kind of got up the nerve to ask him, well, we don't see you out there marching, you know, what are you doing for the cause? And he said, listen, the best thing I can do is play my music. And if I was going to go out there and march, first thing they would do is punch me in the mouth. Without my lips, I can't do what I do best for the cause. The reporter said, oh, you really think they would beat Louis Armstrong? And he said, they would beat Jesus if he was black and marched.
I went in. Ain't got a friend. My only sin is in my skin. What did I do?
Every night during that tour, he does What Did I Do to Be So Black and Blue, which he had originally recorded in 1929. It's known as the first protest song.
In the case of my father, he had Eugene Wright, who was a great bass player. He's African American. There was a whole big Southern tour, and then the head of the school, oh man, you know, we can't have black people playing with white people.
We canceled 23 out of 25 concerts. And that was a blow because I needed that work at that time. One of our last concerts, students were stamping on the floor, and we were in the locker room underneath. And it was such a roar of feet because we were an hour late. The president of the school was talking to the governor. He came back and said to me, we don't want another Little Rock. You go on, but keep your bass player in the back. So the second tune, I told Eugene, your microphone is broken. You'll have to move out in front of the band and use my speaking mic, and I'd like you to do a solo. And boy, that auditorium went crazy. It was integrated with such joy. I'd get to a concert, and if it was segregated, I wouldn't play. Louis Armstrong wouldn't play. The jazz musicians helped the schools back on track.
By the end of 1958, the Brubecks had a script, they had a score, but they had not gotten to Armstrong yet. Joe Glazer, their mutual manager, was doing everything in his power to kind of keep the Brubecks away from Armstrong. Glazer's main thing was how much money could he make out of Louis Armstrong.
Dave lets Joe Glazer know, we're working on a musical. We think it might be something that Louis Armstrong could play a part in. Glazer was a very astute businessman. He said, Dave, you're going to be in Chicago right after Christmas, 1958, and Louis is playing the Empire Room. So why don't you just go by and talk with him? Dave goes to Chicago, goes to the front desk and he asks, please call up to Mr. Armstrong's room. And who answers the phone? Frenchie Taliere, the road manager. Frenchie says, Dave, no, I've got orders from the top. Lewis can't see anybody. He's supposed to rest. It's not going to happen. So Dave plants himself on the hallway floor outside Lewis's room. About 20 minutes later, here comes room service with Lewis's dinner. The door swings open and Lewis goes, Dave, what are you doing sitting there? Oh, I wanted to talk to you, but Frenchie said I could come in, Dave.
Brubeck's got a few minutes to make the elevator pitch, and so he pulls out the lyrics and the sheet music to a song called Lonesome. Lewis kind of recited it like a poem, and it had a very, very deep emotional effect on Dave Brubeck.
Armstrong was like, I'm on board. You tell me when to show up, and I'm there. Lewis says, it would really help me out a lot if you could make some reel-to-reel tapes and send them to me with some of the songs so I can start practicing to them.
Hi, Louie. This is Dave Brubeck. I've just talked to Joe Glazer. He's told me how difficult it will be for you to record any of these things before going to Europe. But I'm hoping that you can figure out the backgrounds with me singing the songs like you asked me to do. I'm ashamed of the horrible way in which I sing, but at least you'll be able to hear the words and you can figure out. Now, Louie, I'd like to introduce you to my wife. She's really the one responsible for the show. It was her idea over 2 years ago to write a Broadway show with you as the lead. She's always considered you the greatest ambassador. So this is my wife, Iola. We call her Oli.
Hello, Louie. I saw you tonight on that show you asked for. It impressed me terrifically and saw the sincerity.
Louis Satchmo Armstrong, the king of jazz.
Hi, everybody. Say, Jack, I think you're wrong about me being the ambassador. I think jazz is the ambassador. It speaks in every language, and it's understood by everyone that wants to listen. I don't know much about politics, but I know these people in foreign countries hear all kinds of things about America. Some good, some bad. I'm pretty sure what comes out of this horn makes them feel better about us. They know a trumpet ain't no cannon. Yeah.
Right now, we're in the middle and scramble of preparing an audition tape for producers to listen to. Dave told me about your reading the song Lonesome in Chicago and how moved he was. If we could even get just this much of you on the audition tape.
Well, Oli, would you like to read Lonesome so Pops can hear?
All of my life, I've been lonely.
All of my life, I've been lonely.
I'll go way back in my past.
I'll go way back.
I'll tell you all about lonesome.
All about
how the winters last and last.
How the winters last and last. Well, Louie, that's proof enough that you'll never be able to make a Nat pull out of me like you said you could. But what I'll do is I'll send you these on a tape that will make.
All of my life, I've been lonely. I'll go way back in my past.
I'll go way back.
I'll tell you all about lonesome.
I'll tell you
how the winters last and last.
They were so thrilled because it involved Louis. And I think my father saw it as a way of getting off the road and creating income, which would free more time for him to write these big orchestral works than he wanted to do. I think also because it represented something that he wanted to achieve with our mom, Iola. They were singing lyrics that my mom had written. As I look back on it, he was thrilled for this to be a musical event that shone the spotlight on her abilities as well. His whole career was really defined about how smart she was.
The 1950s, when you really started to work with your husband.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like being that active as a woman?
Truly a juggling act.
I bet.
I did a lot of the apron strings and getting dinner on the table. That was a given. I was the bookkeeper. I wrote the salaries, took care of the taxes and all of that. wrote program notes, did the bookings for travel. They called me Central Intelligence.
We used to go on the road. It was like a jazz circus family. Dave would make pitiful money, like $100 for a week at a club in Pittsburgh. Go into one of these old hotels.
Very old hotels. Uh-huh. Had very large closets.
Oh. My parents would get the bed. They had a trunk they took in the road, camping gear, where you'd unfold these, you know, little bed frames.
Air mattresses, cooking utensils, books and toys. We had everything in that one footlocker.
And me, as the baby, they just pull out the drawer and throw in some blankets, and that was our crib.
We just made do. I mean, it was like pioneering until they were school age.
When Dave was home from the road, they would spend a good part of every day chauffeuring their kids around to music lessons, dance lessons for Kathy. They'd have two yellow legal pads for the lyrics and story ideas. They'd park outside and they'd have 45 minutes. Dave would come up with doggerel or just sort of gibberish, but it would fit the beats of the music. And then Iola would set about starting to make sense of it and turn it into a song lyric. This was their passion project over a five-year period.
From the moment the Brubecks presented the script and the song Lonesome to Armstrong in Chicago, and they saw how he responded favorably, they knew that the next stop had to be Broadway. They spent much of 1959 and 1960 speaking with major producers. They were open to any and all suggestions, but every time it seemed like they were ready to lock it in and get this producer on board and book the theater, something would come in the way, and that something was usually Joe Glazer.
Joe Glazer was my father's agent slash manager. Before he had anything to do with my father, he was much more intertwined with Louis Armstrong's career. Louis Armstrong first got involved with Joe Glazer because there were two different mafia-controlled jazz clubs who wanted Louis on the same day, and both of them threatened to break his arms and bust his mouth if he didn't play at one or the other. There's only one guy that knows how to stand up to these guys and straighten this out. He's a guy named Joe Glazer.
Joe Glazer is in Chicago in the 1920s, running brothels, nightclubs, boxing matches. He's hanging out with Al Capone's crew, a real kind of shadowy figure. He meets Armstrong in 1926. Flash forward to about 1935. Armstrong is at rock bottom. He was threatened at gunpoint. One of his managers called him the N-word and left Armstrong stranded in Europe without his passport. Armstrong's second wife, Lil, was suing him, and Armstrong's chops, his lips, were all busted up to the point where he couldn't play the trumpet. When he comes back to Chicago, he had no band, he had no gigs, so he calls Glazer, worked out a deal. You pay me a weekly salary, and you pay my personal expenses, you keep the rest. And by the end of 1935, Armstrong is being featured in Esquire magazine, Vanity Fair magazine. He's got a recording contract with Decca. Glazer made sure that all Armstrong had to do for the rest of his life was play the trumpet.
I say, this is my man. I say, you turn the business, Daddy Glazer, and I blow the horn. And that's the way it is. It's been over 20-some years, and we ain't even signed a contract. You understand?
When my parents came up with the idea of the Real Ambassadors, we never quite knew, like, when things were almost happening, if Joe Glazer was doing secret little things to make sure that it couldn't. Thankfully, the thing that did happen was this recording that they did and the famous one performance at the Monterey Jazz Festival.
You are tuned to 999 WJZZ FM, and you're listening to the Dave Brubeck Show. Let's go back and find out about this show that is called The Broadway Show without having reached Broadway. Ole?
Yes, we're now going to record it. As someone at Columbia Records said, the most expensive demo that has ever made.
Here we go, The Real Ambassador, take one. We're rolling.
Keep rolling.
It was a little slower than that, too, last night. That's that. Yeah, we had the lope going.
Then we doubled it.
Yeah.
Okay, one, two, three.
We're the real ambassadors.
It is evident we represent American society, noted for its etiquette, its manners, and sobriety. We have followed protocol with absolute propriety. We're Yankees.
There are some other people involved, too, I understand.
Carmen McRae has the feminine role. And Lambert Hendrickson Ross.
Lambert and Hendrickson Ross, one of the first famous jazz scat vocal group. They were like the Greek chorus.
The Real Ambassadors, the Columbia album, was recorded over about a week's time in September 1961. Armstrong, he knew that this was a challenge. He's 60 years old at this point, and he's learning all these complex Dave Brubeck originals with some of these tongue-twisting Iola Brubeck lyrics. He had absorbed the Brubeck's audio letters, so he is ready. After one take, Brubeck said, "How are your chops doing, Pops?" And Armstrong said, "Don't worry about the chops, it's my brain." He said, "My brain's gonna get worn out with all these lyrics.
Man, if they just let me run things my way, this world would be a swinging place.
Yeah, Pops, what would you do?
First thing I'd do is call a basement session.
Pops, you mean summit conference.
Man, I don't mean a UN kind of session. I mean a jam session.
Louis and the band are visiting in a small kingdom in Africa. The populace choose Louis to be king of the Mardi Gras. He is picked up on the shoulders of the people and marched through the streets. He is proclaimed king for the day.
A fictional thing. 1960, Armstrong goes on his first State Department concert tour. He goes to the Congo. The Congo is in the middle of a civil war in Leopoldville at this point, but they call a 24-hour truce because Armstrong is coming. Carry him in on a throne, basically declared a holiday. And it was like the wildest thing that everything the Brubecks wrote in their script had come true. When the album comes out, the Real Ambassadors, the back cover photo is Louis in the Congo in 1960 being carried on a throne.
If you're king for only a day, how'd you go about having your way?
Well, if my every wish is your command, I'd go and form a swinging band with all the leaders from every land.
I neither smoke nor drink nor swear. My habits are sublime.
And Dave was having dinner with Ella Fitzgerald. He said to her, "You know, Ella, how you doing?" She said, "Well, you know, I'm doing okay, but you know, Dave, my one bad habit is falling in love." And so he come back to my mom, you know, Ella said this, and my mom wrote the lyrics. You know, my one bad habit is falling in love.
My one bad habit is falling in love and falling right out again.
On the recordings that came out of that song, Ella Fitzgerald is listed as a co-composer, even though it was just an accidental thing that fell out of her mouth at dinner.
Don't fall too fast and make it last. The dreams that mattered have all been shattered.
Dave and Iola didn't view the soundtrack recording as another record by Dave Brubeck. They viewed it as getting Columbia to pay to make a demonstration recording. Broadway is the dream.
Coming up is a blues that states the real purpose of the show. You begin to sing, "They say I look like God," while the priests continue their chant.
They say I look like God.
God created man in his image and likeness.
Then God is black, my God.
In the image of God created he them.
If both are made.
Of God created him.
Could thou perchance a zebra be?
Male and female.
They say I look like God. The Brubecks wrote thinking that Armstrong, with his usual jocularity, was going to just take one look at the lyrics and deliver with a little wink. It opens up, if man is made in the image of God, you know, well, you know, could thou perchance a zebra be? You know, if we're black people, white people, was God a zebra? Ha ha. And he thought Louis would kind of just, you know, deliver it with a little chuckle. And Louis shows up in the studio.
Oh,
Lord, please hear my plea.
And he turned that studio into a church.
I still see that our creation was meant to be an act of God to set man free.
They needed to call a break after the take because everybody was just emotionally done.
We are listening to the Real Ambassadors, a rallying cry for integration, cultural exchange, and social justice. It is a story of anti-racism and jazz history, and a love story about the Brubecks and their vision for a better world. It was produced by the Kitchen Sisters, the duo Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva. It's a great lesson about music and its potential social impact on the world and society. Stick around, we will return with the rest of the story right after these brief messages.
Support for KFAI comes in part from First Avenue, presenting the Black Angels in the First Avenue main room Friday, May 29th. Marking 20 years since their debut, the band will be performing songs from their first release along with their greatest hits. Drawing inspiration from psychedelic rock legends while also looking forward, their performance is a way to remember the album that started it all. More information about the Black Angels live in the First Avenue main room is available at first-avenue.com.
Is it time to give your classic car a classic send-off? Honor your car's legacy by donating it to KFAI. Maybe your car isn't technically a classic, but you still want to give it a purpose. Well, we can turn any great ride into a great donation. We accept all kinds of vehicles, from used cars and trucks to RVs and boats. For more information, call us at 855-277-2346 or visit us online at kfai.careasy.org.
Support for KFAI comes in part from the Cedar Cultural Center presenting Sam Prekop and John McIntyre Thursday, May 14th. The former bandmates of The Sea and Cake return to perform together again on the Cedar stage. Prekop and McIntyre continue to expand the definition of rock and the boundaries of electronic music. Their collaborations are guided by instinct, musicianship, and their long history of performing together. More information about Sam Prekop and John McIntyre live at the Cedar is available at thecedar.org. Support for this program comes from KFAI listener members and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. You're listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Radio without boundaries. KFAI needs your support now to keep music and documentaries like this on the air. Please visit kfai.org and click donate. And as you go to do that, we are going to return to today's special documentary produced by Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, better known as the Kitchen Sisters. Here is The Real Ambassadors.
When the record finally came out in 62, I think it kind of sank without a trace at the time. There wasn't too much of a description in the liner notes. You know, one song is about the State Department. Here they are singing about cultural exchange. The next song is Louis Armstrong and Carmen McRae singing a beautiful love song. What was the common thread holding these songs together?
When the record came out, it received almost no radio airplay, but Brubeck's attorney leaked to jazz critic Ralph Gleason a reel-to-reel with a few of the songs from the recording session. Gleason was bowled over.
The Brubecks, Ralph J. Gleason and Jimmy Lyons from the Monterey Jazz Festival, they kind of came up with this way of staging of the Real Ambassadors without quite running it by Joe Glazer. Of course, when Glazer found out about it, he was not happy, but by that point, Lewis had already agreed to do it.
Everybody's coming. Everybody's coming.
Oh, my gosh, Monterey.
Louis Armstrong will appear.
This was the original score. I haven't looked at this in ages. I had written notes saying, turn left and jump to the third note, my own things to learn the music. It says, Lambert, Hendricks, Annie Ross, and I've cut out and said, and Pavan.
For the Monterey performance, Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross transformed into Lambert, Hendricks, and Pavan.
My name is Yolande Pavan. I'm originally from Sri Lanka. I had the great good fortune of singing in the jazz musical written by Dave and Isla Brubeck at the Monterey Jazz Festival, 1962.
They have one day to rehearse here in San Francisco.
Dave was playing piano and Mr. Armstrong was sitting there with a white handkerchief in his hand and his trumpet, and his wife Lucille was sitting next to him. And Louis Armstrong looked at Lucille and said, hey, Mama, I know that girl. I said, in Australia, when I was 15, I'd met Louis Armstrong. Yeah, Mama, I told you.
The intensity of this rehearsal session, they've performed it in the recording studio, but this was going to be live in front of 6,000 people.
When we arrived in Monterey, well, it's so beautiful, the ocean, that big sail kind of water. It was a little bit chilly in the evening. All the musicians and the staff and the crew and all would hang out behind the stage. And in the center was a fire pit. I know, I was huddling. I was wearing a sari, laughing and cracking jokes. And Dizzy was there, and I remember him saying that he was going to run for president, and it would be called the Black House. It was really good times, masking a lot of pain. Well, we did the show. It was amazing. It was live and open air. It was just a glorious night. It brought so many things into focus. The stories behind the music and the lives of the people that played that music. Viola was the narrator. Let me read this. This might give a little bit of... The Real Ambassadors is not a musical drama in the usual sense. Sets and costumes are far more fantastic than any of us could ever see on stage because they exist only in our imaginations. We must paint a view of the world from an airplane window. Build an African village with a church and a palace.
Iola Brubeck stood there, the audience left, the stage would go black, and she would be illuminated, and with a single pin spot, she looked almost like the Delphic Oracle in a dark blue sheath dress, a beautiful gold and white shawl, and her hair was up on top of her head. She stood almost 6 feet tall.
Ladies and gentlemen, our cast of players. For them to see a real, complete piece, like a playlet, this was a storyline. When Louis stands and sings about being ignored by people, you can't move, you're almost paralyzed with emotion. That's why Dave wrote this, that the Real Ambassadors was the music of this country. Music is what overcomes everything. Racial barriers, sociopolitical. Music is energy.
Those present said it was one of the most memorable nights in the career of Armstrong, the career of Brubeck, the history of the Monterey Jazz Festival.
Joyful madness. The applause, the whistles, the shouting.
There's cameras right there. There was recording equipment, and Joe Glazer did not give the green light to have it recorded. But, you know, if you're going to criticize Joe Glazer, start there.
Initially, there was thought, wow, this thing could become a touring show. Glazer was like, well, Lewis is actually already booked all the way through 1964. So within a month of this sensational performance and response, all the different musicians were back on their tour schedules. Within a year, it started to become a distant memory. Iola and Dave, later in the 60s, they wrote a number of large-scale musical works, including oratorios and a mass for Pope John Paul II. So their creative force and energy continued unabated.
We get it swinging, right from the first part.
Yes, my love.
And one of the great songs in that show is Summer Song. Louis always said, the Brubecks have written an opera for me.
Love to me is like a summer day. Silent cause there's just too much to say. Still and warm and peaceful.
The Real Ambassador is trying to get a message through art about what truth is, cultural truth.
Oh, love to me is like a summer day. If it ends, the memories will stay.
On my parents' grave marker, the lyrics to Summer Song are engraved on the back. As my parents, you know, right off into an eternity as partners.
Days are getting long. I can hear sing my summer songs. Come right there and sing. Try it again.
Either one you do.
Insert two, take one.
I can sing. Okay.
I can. Oh, that's where you're taking it? I can sing my summer song.
Dave and Iola Brubeck were married and collaborated for 70 years. They had six kids. Four of them became musicians. Brothers Chris and Dan talk about growing up Brubeck.
My dad used to work in San Francisco. Come home and you'd go to bed. My mom would say, like, you gotta be quiet. Your poor dad didn't go to bed till 3 or 4 in the morning. Part of the technique of keeping us quiet was that we had these little cheap record players almost in every room. We had these Disney records, tunes like Someday My Prince Will Come, Alice in Wonderland. So my dad's asleep. He's hearing da, 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 do, do, do. After a while, he says, you know, those actually are really good tunes, even though they're from cartoons. Then he started playing Someday My Prince Will Come. Miles Davis walks into a club in San Francisco, hears my dad play, and his next record, Miles's record, is called Someday My Prince Will Come. So you're staring at two of the brats that accidentally had something to do with those songs becoming jazz standards, just trying to be quiet. I'm Chris Brubeck. I play in the Brubeck Brothers Quartet, electric fretless bass, and sometimes bass trombone.
I'm Dan Brubeck. I'm a drummer at Brubeck Brothers Quartet.
I'm going to try something different, so I don't...
The house where we grew up in the hills above Oakland. Our kitchen opened up to this studio. It was big enough for a grand piano and for drums to set up. Big bay windows. You could literally see the Golden Gate Bridge, the Bay Bridge, and the Richmond Bridge.
Play this, boy. I want you guys in on the beats you're playing as high as you can play. Oom-pa-da-ba, oom-pa-da-ba, and keep that going.
For me, one of my favorite things to do in the world.
Yeah.
I'd like to hear the group rehearse. I'd crawl under the piano. And there I couldn't be in anyone's way. No one would step on me. And I got to hear all the low overtones of the piano, and I got to hear the bass and the bass drum really well.
I don't think there were too many nights where I didn't fall asleep when he was home to him practicing and composing. He had, in his rehearsals, Morello, who was an incredible drummer. And, of course, we didn't know they were incredible drummers. We just heard all these guys, and they were, you know, oh, it's Uncle Paul, Uncle Joe, you know. So for us, it was just like these guys that were friends of my dad's that played.
Paul was like a visiting member of the octet.
He didn't study with Darius Milhaud, but he got called in to play in my dad's octet, which was the first group that he started. Mostly people that were studying with Darius Milhaud.
Post-World War II, Dave was studying with Darius Milhaud at Mills College. And you figure, why was a famous French composer at Mills College? Because he was a famous French Jewish composer. When the Nazis took over Paris, it was not a great place to be. And Milhaud loved jazz. Milhaud was so open-minded and loved American jazz so much that he said, here's a counterpoint exercise. And old school would be, it would be, you know, Bach Prelude number 2, analyze it. He would say, the chord changes for that popular jazz tune, How High the Moon, are very Bach-like when you think about it. Create an arrangement using counterpoint to that tune. That was like, what a hip professor. And so those kinds of class exercises, based on who played what in that class, was the foundation of the group, the Octet.
Yes, it's How High the Moon. I guess everyone has been exposed to its neat harmonic pattern by now.
Paul Desmond, he said he heard my dad playing. He said, well, there was this crazy Indian guy playing piano, and he was in like 3 keys at the same time. I didn't know where to start, how to play with him. Then he started hearing where he was coming from, and then, you know, he got interested in the whole Darius Milhaud approach.
Polytonality at a jam session in the late 40s was not something you were going to stumble across every day.
It's like, what is this guy doing?
It was originally Paul that heard Joe Morello playing with Mary McPartland and said, I've heard this drummer. He's great. Dave talked to Mary McPartland, and she said, okay, you know, this could work out. Joe said, I'll only leave if you guarantee me that you're going to give me a drum solo every night, because he never got drum solos with Mary. But Paul really had no idea what Joe Unleashed would be like. Well, they did some concerts together, and he got the promised solo. Paul went, wait a minute, I'm supposed to be the guy that's really featured. I wasn't signing up to suddenly have a Buddy Rich in the group or something. So in fact, their very first recording session, it was like high noon or something, Paul said, I'm not going to this recording session if you have Joe Morello on the drums. That's how much I don't want this guy in the group. And Dave said, well, I'm sorry to end the relationship this way, Paul, but I think that this is the perfect guy for our group. And I think they did one session without him, and then Paul blinked first, and then he came to the next one. Then it's music history. There was one family, the Bates brothers. There were 3 bass-playing brothers that lived in San Francisco. So all the musicians knew if you needed a bass player, just call the Bates house. They say, is Norm available, or is Bob, or Phil? I don't know what they're... Norman Bates and Paul were in love with the same woman, a glorious, beautiful woman. And she liked them both. And she said, you know, fellas, I'll make a choice based on which one of you will quit Dave's band. And Norman was willing to, and they ended up getting married. And Paul kept on going in his bachelor ways and staying in Dave's group. When Gene came into the group, Norman had left to be with his new wife, and they needed a new bass player. They knew he was great, rock solid. You know, at that point, it was really important, like, it's the personality. Does he have the personality that is gonna fit with Joe and Paul? And by the way—
There were some personalities there
yeah, you're right.
to fit with.
After a while, Paul just couldn't avoid some kind of grudging respect for the guy that, damn it, took all these drum solos, was winning all the polls in Downbeat magazine for being the best drummer. If it wasn't Buddy Rich, it was Joe. Gene was such a role player. He let everyone do their thing, and he just held the fort. He was African-American. There were tours in the South, and some places they go to play, they would say, wait a minute, we didn't know that you had a black bass player. And Gene could deal with all this stuff and be cool under pressure. He had just had a heart of gold, loving guy.
When my dad would lose it with people like that, but Gene would calm my dad down. because he was used to it. He had gone through it his whole life. He was a real calming element in the band, kind of bridged everyone together all the time.
My father's biggest heroes that he ever knew personally in music were Duke Ellington and Darius Milhaud. It was actually Darius Milhaud that instilled in my father this philosophy, is that when you visit other countries, really keep your ears open.
Everywhere my dad went, he would listen to the street music, whatever people were doing in the schools. He used those influences and brought it into jazz.
The Dave Brubeck Quartet went on this giant State Department tour in 1958. There was 100 concerts in 3 months or some crazy thing. They got to Istanbul, and that's where Dave heard the famous 9/8 beat of 1-2-1-2-1-2-1-2-1-2-1-2-1-2-1-2-1-2-1-2-1-2-1-2-1-2-1-2-1-2-3. He said a melody to that, and that became Blue Rondos.
In that tune, too, he also had the blues. Obviously, that's like the most American form of jazz. He collected all those things, and it was maybe some of the first fusion music or world music.
The pinnacle, the zenith for us all culturally, politically, was when Dave finally got the Kennedy Center honors. For Dave, who probably had performed for just about every president, you don't get the Kennedy Center Award posthumously. So we thought, like, how old does Dave have to get to have this happen? But it was so beautiful that it happened when Obama was president.
Thank you. On behalf of Michelle and myself, welcome to the White House.
Obama, as our president, stood for all the advances in our society that we hoped would happen when they were big into their civil rights efforts.
Now, these performers are indeed the best. They are also living reminders of a simple truth. And I'm going to steal a line from Michelle here. The arts are not somehow apart from our national life. The arts are at the heart of our national life. You can't understand America without understanding jazz. And you can't understand jazz without understanding Dave Brubeck.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Dave Brubeck All-Star Quintet. Bill Charlap, Christian McBride.
The known band was Christian McBride on bass, Miguel Zenon on sax, Bill Charlap on piano, Bill Stewart on drums, and John Faddis on trumpet. Then Herbie Hancock, he came out and he jammed on take five with those guys. Dave right away said, because the artist being honored never plays, he said, I want my sons to play. And the director said no, much to Dave's disappointment. Through the whole thing, he's going, I'm so bummed out that, you know, you guys aren't playing. That's what's really unique to me, that somehow we did it as a family. Secretly, we were supposed to play. Dave had no idea that Dan was with his family in Washington, and Matthew, our youngest brother, they were secreted away in different hotels. He knew that Darius, who had flown in from Africa, was there, and that I was there. We were basically lying through our teeth because we're having these rehearsals backstage. So he really didn't know.
Ladies and gentlemen, the four sons of Dave Brubeck.
And we were playing Blue Rondo a la Turk together. Then they had a version of Take Five, which also included the U.S. Army Jazz Band.
Ladies and gentlemen, the jazz ambassadors of the U.S. Army Field Band.
The U.S. Army Jazz Band now is an integrated group. But my dad, World War II, was in Patton's Army and he was on the front. He put together the first integrated Army band.
Then we all watched it at my house when it was really broadcast. And then we're singing like, wow, wait till we hear Herbie Hancock played his ass off on that. Then we're going, oh my God, they cut Herbie Hancock out of take five. And we're going like, we're toast. They're never going to show us now. And son of a gun, they kept us.
And it was my dad's birthday, too.
Right.
That was the other part of it. So somehow in the middle of Blue Rondo, we managed to sneak in happy birthday.
A polytonal version. When I did get a chance to shake Barack Obama's hand, I said, well, it's good to see you again. And his book, called Dreams of My Father. His father, in an effort to do something cool with his son to help them bond, took them to the Honolulu Symphony to see Dave Brubeck and his sons play with the Honolulu Symphony. And he writes about it in his book. That's when I discovered jazz.
And I know personally how powerful his performances can be. In the few weeks that I spent with my father as a child, he came to visit me for about a month when I was young. One of the things he did was to take me to my first jazz concert in Honolulu, Hawaii, in 1971. And it was a Dave Brubeck concert. And I've been a jazz fan ever since. So the world that he opened up for a 10-year-old boy was spectacular. And Dave, for the joy that you've given
after the gig, there was a big sort of cast party. We walk in, we see Sting is literally kind of on one knee talking to Dave on the way out of there. I said, "Dad, that was really cool." And he says, "Is this Bruce Springsteen a big deal?" This tune, Thank You, or Jim Coulier, Dave was on that 58 tour, and he went to a museum that used to be Chopin's house. And Dave's mother, our grandmother, Bessie, played Chopin all the time on the piano, and my dad grew up hearing that. When he saw Chopin's piano in his house, it really was very meaningful to him. Then he went to play the concert that night, and that melody was still burning in his brain so strong. He's the kind of ear player who would have the moxie to just play it at the concert. He also met with someone who came backstage and said, "Hey, we just want you to understand you're going to get a very tepid response tonight from the audience. If we really show how much we love your music, which we've heard in Voice of America, and we applaud very enthusiastically, the communist police and soldiers that are in the audience will stop the concert just to further punish us. So tell the guys in the group that we love it." And so they played this tune, Thank You, for the first time. And then Dan and I played in Poland with Darius, and there were people in their 90s in wheelchairs that came up to us and said, "We were in the audience the day your dad played this tune for the first time." There were tears streaming down their eyes when they talked about it. Dave had that amazing skill where he can write something that it just resonates with audiences. And for Dan and I, who have been playing with him for probably 50 or 60 years, what are the odds that my brothers and my sister and I, that we would end up coming through the universe into this family, and four out of the six of us becoming professional musicians? It's just great that he's part of our music and we're an extension of his music, and we've all done this together.
Ambassadors was produced by the Kitchen Sisters, Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson, and Brandy Howell, in collaboration with Jackson Spinner. Mixed by Jim McKee. Thanks to Keith Hatcheck, Chris and Dan Brubeck, Ricky Riccardi, Yolande Bavan, Lisa Cohen, and Wynton Marsalis. For use of the rich archival audio in this story, we thank the Louis Armstrong Educational Foundation. You can find out more about this amazing collection at louisarmstrongfoundation.org. You also heard selections from the complete Louis Armstrong Columbia and RCA Victor studio sessions. And we thank Michael Bellicosa and the Brubeck Collection, Wilton Library, Wilton, Connecticut, and Tish and Chris Brubeck. The Milken Family Foundation Archive Oral History Project interview by Eugenia Zuckerman, and the Library of Congress. Support for the Kitchen Sisters comes from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Robert Sillins Family Foundation, Kalita A. Doolin Foundation, Susie Tompkins Buell Fund, and listener contributions to the Kitchen Sisters Productions. Listen to more stories at kitchensisters.org. Thanks for listening.
The Real Ambassadors was produced by the radio production duo The Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva. For more information about this story, I suggest you head to the St. Paul Public Library, where they have two great resources, a PBS video documentary called The Jazz Ambassadors, which they have on DVD. They've also got a great book, Satchmo Blows Up the World, The Jazz Ambassadors Play the Cold War, by Penny Von Eschen. Check them out, literally. Support for this program comes from KFEI listener members, just like yourself. And if you ever miss an episode, just visit KFEI.org, where you can hear all the shows for KFEI archived for 2 weeks or on demand using the KFEI mobile app. Thank you for listening to Mini Culture Presents here on Fresh Air Community Radio, KFEI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Radio without boundaries. Stick around for the Upside Down.